From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're taking a listen back to some of the most meaningful conversations this year. Just before the start of the new year, the U.S. Surgeon General issued an advisory addressing the mental health crisis among America's youth. In Sacramento County, the Office of Education launched an initiative that they say isn't really being done elsewhere in the state, binding together healthcare and schools and placing a mental health clinician across the county's more than 300 campuses. Back in January, I spoke with Dave Gordon, the Sacramento County Superintendent of Schools, and Dr. Christopher Williams, who's the Director of School-Based Mental Health and Wellness, about the launch and how they secured ongoing funding to ensure it sticks around. Superintendent Gordon, in June of 2020, Sacramento County Office of Education, or SCOE for short, announced an initiative to make schools centers of wellness, to place mental health clinicians in every school in the county over the next several years. Let's just start off with the backstory. Where did this vision begin?
This has been a dream of ours for many years. We have always lacked consistent mental health support and services in our schools. Three-year grants came and went. The inadequate staffing that schools were able to muster without funding sources always kept us from having the kind of social-emotional supports for young people that would prevent the kinds of tragedies like suicides and other things that needed to be treated. So our dream over the years was to figure out a way to put sustainable mental health supports in partnership with the medical system into our schools, and with the collaboration, and I give a big shout out to County Mental Health and the County Health Department to join with us to create a system by which we could put clinicians in the schools and reimburse the services of the clinicians through the regular medical system, meaning Medi-Cal for those that were eligible for that, and ultimately we'll be looking at the private medical plans as well. Now, the second goal, though, was really to help turn the schools into what we call centers of wellness, because everybody is familiar with treatment, but we shouldn't be focused on treatment. We should be focused on prevention, and we should be focused on every person in the school building having a feel for how can we best meet the mental health needs of young people up front, not after they're already suffering.
Why are Medi-Cal reimbursements better than grants?
Well, Medi-Cal reimbursements are sustainable over time. In other words, that's part of what your medical plan should provide, support for young people. And the young people shouldn't have to go down to an appointment somewhere if that's not the best way to serve them. And the school is a great partner because families trust the schools. The schools are in their neighborhoods. So I think it's a win-win on all sides.
Yeah. When it comes to the challenges, was it easy to get Medi-Cal reimbursements? And really, how many students and families does this cover in the county, in Sacramento County?
Well, about 60-something percent of families are on Medi-Cal in the county. So that's a large number of our families in the schools. We have 245,000 students or so in the county. And the health plans, it is not easy to generate the reimbursement.
So essentially, this ultimate goal, if you're in the Medi-Cal system, which is roughly 60% of students in the county, you get a referral for your child to go to a clinician or a therapist, but there will actually be one at the school as opposed to traveling to a provider. So essentially removing barriers.
Right. But also we're injecting into the school the work and the wisdom of a professional in the social work and counseling field who's connected to the medical system. So we're binding the interests of the two parties together, which we probably should have been doing all along. But I think the value of that partnership will grow as this program rolls forward. And like I said, we will also be working to involve the private health plans in this as well.
You launched this in the first year of the pandemic, June of 2020. How many schools now have clinicians?
We have clinicians in around 20 schools throughout the county. And people ask me, well, there's 300 odd schools. And how are you going to get to 300 odd schools? And my answer is, well, one at a time. And I think the value of the program will speak for itself over time. And again, I really give a shout out to Chris and these pioneer clinicians who are doing a marvelous job basically inventing this program as they fly the plane.
Dr. Christopher Williams, this is where you come in, helping chip away at this. You're the Director of Mental Health and Wellness at SCOE. Share a little of your background and what brought you here.
Sure. So I'm from the East Coast. I lived in New York City for a little over 20 years. I'm a social worker. I'm an educator. Served as a school social worker in a couple schools in the Bronx in New York. Helped to develop a mentoring program back in New York City as an intervention for chronically absent students, which led to a citywide campaign. They call it Success Mentors, mentoring as an intervention for chronically absent students. Understanding, of course, that chronic absenteeism is really a symptom, right? The chronic absenteeism is not the problem to solve. And we discovered this along our journey, that chronic absenteeism is a symptom of other concerns that students and families are experiencing. I ultimately led a nonprofit back there in New York City, providing mental health, school-based mental health services. Fortunate enough to have come out here and landed at SCOE at a time, under Superintendent Gordon's leadership and the vision of this program. Really excited to be leading it. But I think that experience is important in the sense that student behaviors are really indicators of what's happening. And so how do we create interventions that, as Superintendent Gordon mentioned, is treatment for young people who are experiencing mental illness or mental disorders, but also getting a little bit further upstream to think about how can we co-create experiences between the adults and the kids that mitigate that trauma, so that we are helping as schools, as centers of wellness, is really intended not as just to provide treatment, but to create experiences where young people are on a healthy developmental trajectory and that the adults in schools can really support that.
Well, in talking about this intersection and making schools as centers of wellness, that also means changing the conversation surrounding mental health and also the role of schools and community. How do you teach that to adults working at schools?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. We have a paradigm. We are continuing to develop and evolve that paradigm, but we also have to be responsive of the communities that we serve, right? Galt and River Delta are not the same as Sac City or San Juan. And we have to understand the communities that we are serving. But the way we teach it, I think it was Daniel Goleman who talked about how we teach empathy is by developing self-awareness, right? If we say empathy is identifying in somebody else, then building self-awareness is I can identify more things about myself and therefore identify more things about others. And so to teach this, we have to really begin with the adults. What were your experiences when you were in school? Who were adults who really developed great relationships with you? How are you channeling those experiences when you come into your schools? How can you, develop a reflective practice of your own, whether that's mindfulness, whether it's exercise, whether it's building relationships with other adults, but how can you build an awareness of yourself and awareness of your role as what Dr. Jack Shonkoff calls a protective adult relationship? And how do you develop those protective adult relationships with the young people you serve? Hmm.
Given that Sacramento County has brought on 20 clinicians at schools across the county out of, some 300 schools, what were you looking for when hiring those 20 clinicians?
I've been asked this question a couple of times, and the first thing that comes to mind is people who have that entrepreneurial spirit, people who are willing to sit in the unknown, people who are willing to take risks for trial and error. There's almost like a sense of you have to be willing to fail. You have to be willing to try things, understand that it didn't work, and then try something new the next day. And the folks that we've hired, I've said this a couple of times, if I did anything right last year, it was hiring the right people. We have a group of clinicians who excel not only at their clinical skills, but at their ability to develop relationships with the adults, to really understand systems and the systems of the schools and the systems of the communities in which they serve, and how to really intervene at the systems level, as well as at that individual level.
I go back to when you were talking about chronic absenteeism as a symptom. How does this change understanding when to discipline and how to discipline a student?
No easy answers, right? Your questions are really spot on, and we have to develop these answers in partnership, I think. One of the critical components of this program, in addition to having clinicians on school sites, is we're developing what we call coordination of services teams, or COST teams, at each site. And those COST teams are made up of our clinicians, but also school administrators, teachers, counselors. It's a multidiscipline. Sometimes we call it a multidiscipline team. And what we're trying to suggest to schools is don't send referrals to the clinicians. Send referrals to this coordination of services team. And to some respect, it should be similar, all adults in schools are mandated reporters. And the law is that you don't have to have evidence of child abuse or maltreatment. You have to have a suspicion of child abuse or maltreatment to make a referral to Child Protective Services. We want to kind of further that analogy a little bit to say that you don't need to know that a child is suffering from mental illness. You need to have a suspicion that something is going on that needs a little extra support. And when you have that suspicion, make the referral to COST. Make the referral to this team that can then devote time and resources to investigating, to engaging with the young person, to engaging with the family, and to discovering what's going on and how we can develop an intervention, which may be mental health, right? It might be therapy, but it might be some other type of intervention that somebody else in the school or community can develop. And so we have to understand that student behavior is the way that we interpret student behavior often determines how we proceed. And so we have to recognize that student behavior is indicative of something else. Student behavior is not the problem. We have to interpret that behavior as a way to how do we then find out what the problem is that then we can address.
Superintendent Gordon, I want to bring you back in because we're talking about prevention rather than being reactive, essentially. Did Sac County model this after other school districts? Does this exist anywhere else?
We did have a visit a couple of years ago to Fresno County, and they were piloting this with a different funding model, which might or might not be sustainable. So we went for what we thought was the most sustainable model because, again, the biggest issue for the school people is doing something that can be sustained so that everybody understands that this is serious, this is long-term, and this is a commitment to our young people and our families. The other thing that we're really, really committed to is amplifying the voice of young people, as Dr. Williams mentioned, in fashioning these strategies. That's very, very important. And I give a big shout out again to the county, which has created a youth mental health board, which reports directly to the Board of Supervisors. I don't think that's been done anywhere else in California. And I think that holds great promise for us. So that's a big priority. The other big priority going forward from here is to move these interventions down into the 0 to 5 space. In other words, these traumas that affect young people, they don't start when the child turns 5. Many of them start much earlier. So we need to find a way to reach out to our preschools, our childcare facilities, and families throughout the community.
That was my conversation with Dave Gordon, the Sacramento County Superintendent of Schools, and Dr. Christopher Williams, who's the Director of School-Based Mental Health and Wellness, about the groundbreaking initiative to place a mental health clinician at every school in the county, creating centers of wellness for their local communities. Our conversation first aired in January. Up next, we'll listen and learn from Sacramento County's inaugural Youth Advisory Board about what's missing in behavioral and mental health support on campuses. You're listening to a special edition of Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're taking a look back at conversations that are still impacting us today. We just heard about Sacramento County Office of Education's unparalleled initiative to transform schools into centers of wellness, and at its core, changing the conversation surrounding mental health for youth. In tandem, the county appointed its first-ever youth advisory board. The board members range between 14 and 24 years old and shape policy that directly impacts mental and behavioral health resources for their peers. Back in January, I spoke with Sydney Spitzer, who is the Pro Youth and Families Programs Coordinator for the Behavioral Health Youth Advisory Board, as well as three of the inaugural Youth Advisory Board members: Savannah Carmu, the CEO of the nonprofit Happy Heart Advices; Jordan Kaitapu, the founder of the Black Alumni of Folsom Cordova Unified School District; and Trazel White, who's writing two books: 5 Phrases to Change Someone's Life and 15 Steps to Love Someone with a Mental Illness. Well, Sydney, starting with you, can you tell us about Pro Youth and Families and how the nonprofit became part of the Sacramento County Youth Advisory Board?
Yeah, absolutely. Pro Youth and Families is a nonprofit that is going on their 40th year anniversary at this point in time. And they have been an integral part of Sacramento's youth collaboratives so far. And so the county, in the midst of the pandemic, looked to Pro Youth and Families as a deeper support for schools and the county in order to create a deeper collaboration with youth. And so Pro was asked to be a support to the county in developing a youth board.
The Youth Advisory Board was signed into ordinance January of 2021. When going through the applications, what were you looking for and what stands out to you about the first cohort of members?
Yes, as I've mentioned in previous, I was not part of the recruitment process for the board members. So we did have a total of 44 applicants, which was just phenomenal to see those types of numbers come from our youth. And it reaffirms the fact that we needed a youth advisory board. Plenty of youth are ready to speak out and speak for what they need. And so the members that we have are some of the most stellar and engaged community members from our youth in Sacramento. So as you've said here today, we have Savannah, Jordan, and Trazel, and just who these people are in means of their own personal personality and the way in which they choose to take on community engagement is an accurate representation of all the applicants we received. It was extremely difficult for us to decipher between applicants. So we are internally grateful for who we ended up with in this first cohort.
And the first months have obviously been onboarding and development, but what are the overall goals of the Youth Advisory Board?
That's a great question. The overall goals of the Youth Advisory Board is to find a way for youth voice to be implemented into policy. And so that will begin with focusing specifically on county behavioral health policy in regards to youth services. And moreover, they will also be, in the overarching, will be focusing on ways to implement their voice in the services sector. So that means that the county will be developing their services website for youth, and these youth will take on that role as well. And then separately from the county, the youth also are looking for different ways to promote accessibility of services across Sacramento.
Well, let's get to the board members. Savannah, 15 years old, you are the CEO already of Happy Hearts Advice. What inspired you to apply for the Youth Advisory Board?
Hi, Vicky. Thank you so much for having me. So first of all, I've been involved in the health industry for the past 8 years, and I have been working with youth and educating them about their hearts and the importance of living a wholesome lifestyle through my organization. So really reaching out to impact youth physically and mentally has been a huge passion of mine. And for most of my life, I've been brought up in a low-income neighborhood that didn't really have the best mental health support that the government could provide. But fortunately, my parents would always urge me to think outside the box. And I grew up believing that my environment was not the definition of who I truly was. So I'm so blessed to be raised in such a supportive environment. But the same can't really be said for my peers and the friends that I grew up with. And depression and high-linked anxiety are rampant at my school. So my parents' support system allowed me to follow my dreams. And as a result, I became so much more vocal about the issues I deeply cared about. And I really strive to make a difference. So that was really the background of how I became interested in mental health and why I decided to sign up for this board.
Well, that strive is becoming a reality. Thank you so much for sharing that. That is just so incredible. Jordan, moving to you, you founded the Black Alumni of Folsom Cordova Unified School District. What led you down that path and ultimately leading you to become an inaugural Youth Advisory Board member in Sacramento County?
Thank you so much for having us. It's a great opportunity that I appreciate in daily. I had a background in social justice for the last 6 years. I spent my last 2 years of high school as an organizer for my Black Student Union. And after I graduated, I continued my advocacy efforts through the organization Black Alumni of FCUSD. And basically, my organization's sole goal is to amplify Black students' voices and demand educational equity within our school district as well, and provide resources and mentorship as needed. As someone who has had battles with mental health, it's reassuring to know that someone with my best interest in mind is advocating for better and more accessible services for me and my peers who may be going through something that also requires additional support. So it's important to me that other youth have that reassurance as well.
Yeah, and you're advocating for them too. Trazelle, you sent me a TikTok of motivating others, and I have to say that it was just so welcoming and supportive and really just like electrifying in all the warmest, best ways. Can you tell us about your journey and what led you to becoming a Youth Advisory Board member?
Yes, I can. Hello, good morning, everyone. What led me to becoming a board member was really my own story. I have been diagnosed with a couple of different mental illnesses, such as schizophrenia, major depression disorder, bipolar disorder, and insomnia. And I've also been in mental health court, and I'm now on the mental health board. And there are many reasons that I wanted to be on the board. One of the many reasons would have to be that I didn't see anybody supporting us. I was talking to one of my friends, and he's a little older than me, grew up in Folsom. I was talking to him and I said, mental illness never really was a thing until now. He said, no, mental illness has been a thing in my neighborhood. So I was like, dang, that means it just wasn't one in my neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, each of you have such unique life experiences. And I want to ask each of you, what has been missing in behavioral and mental health services on campuses, and how can the county provide more meaningful access and support for students? I mean, that's why y'all became board members. Trazelle, I'll start with you.
I feel like the biggest thing that's missing right now is youth. I don't just mean youth as in 0 to 12. I mean youth that are my age, those that are very close to the 18 and below, because we actually know some sense of what they're going through because we're still going through it. And we can see their pain. We can see their triumphs. We can see their struggles. And we have a better understanding of how to help them. And I was just in a meeting yesterday, another board meeting, and they were starting something called Near the Peer. And it's when we have college students being a mentor to those that are 18 to 15. And then we have mentors that are 15 to 18 mentoring middle schoolers.
Jordan, what conversations have been taking place among your peers in the realm of like what's missing when it comes to support on campus? I mean, what Trezell was talking about is kind of like peer-to-peer counseling and having someone closer to your age group being a mentor because they're going through similar things that you're going through.
Yeah, absolutely. Youth value services that are culturally relevant as well and restorative justice based that ultimately focuses on the growth of the student versus the punishment. Unfortunately, as far as students can tell, actually on these campuses, those services can be either unknown to the students, unobtainable, or altogether non-existent. So there's also an absence currently of a peer-to-peer support structure in the school setting, which I'm happy to hear that Sacramento is actively doing something about that and investigating that. In addition to that, you know, students' material conditions may also fuel their need for extra support. You know, they should be met in an equitable fashion as well. And, you know, schools should be a hub of resources for youth, since youth spend most of their time there anyways, as well as utilizing social media to increase awareness of programs of the county that the county already offers as well. One of the main issues that we've seen is just the lack of knowledge of programs that already exist.
Yeah, and resources can be out there, but if you're not aware of it, that doesn't really do much good. Savannah, you know, when it comes to, you know, what we're chatting about peer-to-peer counseling, you're the CEO of Happy Heart Advices, and you've been doing it now for 8 years. What's the best way to make these resources and support accessible to your peers?
I think, first of all, knowledge is power. So just being able to know about the services that the county provides is the very first step. And then also, as we're talking about peer-to-peer counseling, it's just so important to just reach out and impact youth. And I know that when kids have the right support system and the proper resources, they can do anything that they put their mind to. And I know that the Youth Advisory Board truly wants to be a force of change in our fellow peers' lives. And counseling is amazing in itself. But what's even greater is when youth come together to support other youth. It's just truly such a powerful thing. And we have a powerful voice, so we need to use it. And we are starting to use it. So I'm just so excited for that.
Savannah, what have you learned from your fellow board members?
I've learned the importance of working together as a team. You know, it's one thing when you are leading out and you are raising out your voice for something you're passionate about, but doing it together as a team is just even more powerful. The power that it holds when you know that a group of people have come together for a united cause is just so amazing and wonderful in itself.
Trezell, what have you learned from your board members?
I would have to say I've learned to never give up. I've learned that the book that I'm writing, Five Phrases to Change Someone's Life, and the other book, 15 Steps to Love Someone with a Mental Illness, they're more needed now than ever. I've learned that I should have started something when I was younger, and that would have helped my peers around me because we grew up with a bunch of mental illnesses. And I would like to say that I'm a man that likes both men and women. And part of the problem with while growing up for me personally was not having someone to show me how to approach another man. And I went to Sac High, and personally, it was cool for girls to like other girls, and they had someone showing them how to do it. We didn't. And I feel as if we just need to put more of everything into the schools, not just one thing, because it's a spectrum of problems, not just one.
Right. And being able to live authentically. Jordan, what have you learned from your fellow board members?
I really appreciate that collectively as a board, we've all, you know, expressed concern for the more marginalized parts of our community and making sure that they're represented in our board as well. Even though we all come from different demographics, I think it's really important that we continue to amplify marginalized student voices or youth voices in general, whether that's from incarcerated youth or formerly incarcerated youth or youth battling substance abuse or homelessness or anything along the lines of that.
What advice do you have for someone that's interested in applying to become a youth advisory board member in Sacramento County? Jordan?
If you are interested in applying to become a youth advisory board member, I highly recommend that you just go for it. You shoot your shot. You know, of course, youth always needs more representation, especially when it comes to getting input on policy that directly impacts them and their peers. It's a great learning experience and a good way to network and meet other youth that are also passionate about behavioral health.
Trezell, what recommendations do you have for someone who's interested in applying?
My recommendations would be representation matters. Your voice matters. If you don't speak out for you, who will? Closed mouth doesn't get fed. And, you know, like, don't say you can't do it, because that's one of the things that I said I couldn't do. And be vulnerable in your application.
Yeah. Being vulnerable, especially. And then now even hearing from the three of you with each of your own experiences, having, you know, a support system in terms of advocacy. Savannah, what advice do you have for someone that wants to apply?
Backing off of what Jordan and Trezell just said, if you're interested in applying for this position, I just say go for it, you know? And when you're working on your application, just show your honest self. Show why you're passionate for this, and then tell your story, because I think that your story is the most important part of you in this entire process, because we are not looking for an expert on mental health, and we are certainly not looking for perfection. We're simply looking for a person who's passionate about mental health and wants to be a part of that change. So I say, go for it and give it your all.
Well, before we let you all go, I mean, you all are young and have just such a long, long, wonderful life ahead of you. But clearly, you already have a lived understanding of advocacy and support. So with that wisdom, what would you tell your younger self, or even like someone your age, a peer, dealing with hardships that you have gone through? Savannah?
I would say that your hardships don't define who you are. A lot of the times, as a society, we tend to link what people are going through with their personality, and that's so totally not true. And it's just such a toxic mindset. So I would say that just make sure you separate your circumstances from who you truly are, because your circumstances don't define who you are and what you can do and what you can become in the future.
Yeah, that is so profound and really a constant reminder that we all have to tell ourselves, regardless of how old we are. Jordan, what would you tell, you know, either your younger self or a peer that has dealt with something that you've personally gone through?
I think it's important to emphasize the fact that you are allowed to feel how you feel about any of your hardships or trauma that you are experiencing. And, you know, even when it comes to being in school or working or anything like that, if you need to take a step back to value your mental health, that sort of thing, then you should absolutely do that and put your better self forward when you're stepping into the world moving after that.
Yeah, like checking in and obviously listening to yourself, and especially when it comes to self-care. Trezell, what would you tell your younger self?
I would tell my younger self that in my book, Five Phrases to Change Someone's Life, one of the phrases is, I see you. I would tell myself I see you, because I have six siblings and a twin, and I felt like I was alone my whole life. And I feel as if mental health did have a part in that. And like Jordan said, like, when you're feeling your emotions, feel your emotions. The thing is, don't stay in it, though. I would tell them there will only be a storm for so long, and the sun has to come out and shine, and just don't give up.
Yeah. Feelings are important, but feelings are not facts, and you don't want to live in them and indulge in them. Sydney, I'm going to bring you back in. Let's end with you. What would you tell, after everything you've heard, what would you tell your younger self for dealing with something that you've gone through?
You know, I actually love this question. I thank you for bringing it to me. My favorite quote has always been, be the change you want to see in the world. And so when it comes to what I would tell my younger self, it would be that it's okay to be vulnerable, and you are valid when being yourself. Do not expect any less from yourself, truthfully. I think that one thing that's beautiful about our board members is that the things I would want to say to myself are a lot of the traits that they just seem to emulate. They are all very comfortable in being themselves, and in that they validate an adult like me feeling comfortable being myself when I sit down at their board meetings. So I appreciate having all of them here to lead by example for not just youth, but for adults in our Sacramento community as well.
That was my conversation with Sydney Spitzer, the Pro Youth and Families Program Coordinator for the Behavioral Health Youth Advisory Board, as well as the inaugural Youth Advisory Board members, Savannah Carmu, the CEO of the nonprofit Happy Heart Advices, Jordan Kaitapu, the founder of the Black Alumni of Folsom Cordova Unified School District, and Trezell White, who's writing two books, Five Phrases to Change Someone's Life and 15 Steps to Love Someone with a Mental Illness. Our conversation first aired back in January. Still ahead, we'll meet a Sacramento artist who's transformed life's obstacles into inspiration, from homelessness to foster homes, and now with murals on display across the city and wide open walls. You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're closing a special best of show with an inspiring story of rising above adversity. I initially met Jermaine Tilson a couple of years ago at a foster program with Volunteers for America in Sacramento. Jermaine aged out of the foster care system and experienced homelessness, but continued to create and paint. I caught up with Jermaine back in February about his recent accomplishments and personally how creating a family deepened his passion. Jermaine, I remember I met you about 2 years ago. Take me back to that time. Where were you as an artist and your journey that led you to becoming an artist?
2 years ago, honestly, I guess you could say that I was kind of still trying to get to a point where, you know, I could say that I kind of like professional, but like I knew that I was on a path that was like, you know, I'm on the right path. So it was a bit different too. My style was a little bit different, my art style, and also my lifestyle was a lot different. You know, I was in a transitional housing for former homeless foster youths, and it was really really difficult for me. But you know, I had a lot of support in my circle, so I think it really. It was really a big difference, but it was also like, you know, I knew it was going to go somewhere, you know?
When you were going from foster home to foster home and you were transitional youth that was experiencing homelessness, I mean, you really turned obstacles into inspiration. Share with us the obstacles in your life that led to this really wonderful work that you have as an artist.
I think that it's more like, you know, the obstacles that, like you were saying, like kind of like turn inspiration, like I had gave myself these options, like I could get upset or I could put myself in a situation where things could be a lot harder, but I knew that people believed in me, and I used that those people that believed in me and the situation that I was going through to create something beautiful out of it. And I think that that's what gave me a lot of the opportunities, you know. So, you know, times when, you know, like when I was homeless, it was really hard, but you know, I always kept a canvas and I always kept painting. And I think that like in any time in life, like when things hard, like as long as you continue to work and push through that, it's gonna make you be wherever you want to be, you know what I mean? Or even just have that support, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think when it comes to the issue of homelessness, there's a lot that people don't understand. And through your experience, what led you to going through that, to becoming unhoused?
So at the time when I was in foster care, I was 20, turned 21. So I was legally still able to be in an actual like foster home with foster parents. And, you know, that particular foster parent that I was with ended up getting like evicted from her apartment. and I had nowhere to go, you know, and I was like about to be 21 in less than like 3 weeks, you know, so, you know, and I had nowhere to go. So I kind of was just like kind of moving around in places that I knew that I used to live at before, like, and I found this little area where I kind of like, it was really warm and I'd stay underneath there and sleep under there. And I had my little canvas and work there. So, but really it started from there, you know, just kind of just where I was like kind of fit similar neighborhoods that I used to live in and kind of just found a place that was kind of safe and kind of warm a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, it was something that I didn't expect was going to happen. You know, it really was, you know, I was like, I never would have thought I would be in this position. And it wasn't 100% my fault, but, you know, I had to make the best out of it. So that's really how I became in that situation.
What led you, or how did you find out about Volunteers of America? Because that really was a turning point for you.
Yeah, so it's crazy. Because, you know, I had a library card. So I'd go to the library all the time, you know, during the day, you know, because it's open, it's public. So I'd go to the library and I just looked online. I just Googled, like, transitional housing, because I used to live in the Bay Area and they had like this transitional housing, but I was too old for it. So I looked up transitional housing for people after 21, and I found this program called Adolfo on Google, and I was like, and I found their number and I was like, hey, is it possible if I could use a phone here? And I called and they said, yes, we have interviews every Tuesday, so come. And I ended up taking a bus over there and then ended up going to the interview. And then that's how I got into VOA's Adolfo, you know, kind of just doing my own research. Cause I feel like, you know, I realized that like a lot of things that I want, like, you know, it's not going to come by just sitting here, you know? So I had to like put in the work to figure it out, you know?
And I would imagine that experience was way more than just like having a roof over your head. It gave you stability and you also got some mentorship out of it.
Oh yes. I got a lot of mentorship. I feel like, you know, I mean, I still have connections with those people that I met through VOA, and a lot of the opportunities that I've gotten are mainly because of them, you know, and I'm thankful for them.
And that's what brought me to you in 2019. You were painting a mural there at the Volunteers of America site. And 2 years later, you are a successful artist. You've been a part of Wide Open Walls. People can see your work on the LED screen at Golden One Center. For people who haven't seen your work, describe it. How do you want people to feel when they take in your artwork?
What I want people to feel when they take in my artwork is, you know, and I also want them to like kind of like see it too, like, because there's a story in everything that I create. What I want them to see and feel is like what I went through. Like, there's a story, like, you know, when there's a story, you gotta kind of understand it. And yes, art is your own perspective, but like when I create my art, like, you know, there's always an emotion that I was feeling, and I want people to be able to like see that through the colors, you know, because if you ask me, I think certain colors represent different emotions. So, you know, if there's red, you know, some people think that that's like a really like bright color. Some people think it's an angry color. But basically what I want people to get out of when they see my work is, you know, he has a story, you know, he was going through something, and this is going to make me feel some type of way when I look at this, or when I buy this piece of work. It's not just, oh, it's going to go on my wall. Like, it's something that's going to make me feel emotion. I'm going to have an emotional connection to it. So that's what I want people to get when they see my work, you know.
How do you describe your process to how you work as an artist?
As my process, I think how I work as an artist, it sounds crazy, but sometimes it can be very like stressful, but like I know that it's like really, it's really fulfilling, you know? Like, it's something that takes time, but when I take my time, it comes out perfect. It comes out the way that I love it, you know? And I think that that's important with artwork or any form of art, is knowing how you feel when you're going through it, you know?
Yeah. You have so many people who have taken in your work. You know, as I mentioned, you know, you've participated in Wide Open Walls, and people can see it at Golden One Center. Has there been feedback that you've received over the last couple of years that really sticks with you and warms your heart about how it makes people feel?
Yes. Actually, it's crazy that you said that, because yesterday I was painting at a live painting at one of my mentor's events that he had. And he said this to me, he's like, you know, your work, it's changed and it's evolved. And, you know, it's not only evolving, it's like it's popping off the canvas. It's coming off of the art. It's turning, emerging into something. So that really stuck with me and made me feel really happy. It's like someone that I know personally has seen me come from here and see the difference in the evolution of my art.
Hmm. I want to talk about the artwork that is right behind you. It's Muhammad Ali. Describe it. It's so vibrant and it really lends itself to what your mentor said. It's like popping off of the wall and we're like in a Zoom chat right now.
So this piece is called Power and Will. And, you know, I mean, it's Ali in there, but, you know, it's more than just Muhammad Ali, you know, because, like, you know, when Muhammad Ali, like, he was boxing, like, it was a really hard time for, you know, for African-Americans. But, you know, he kept doing his thing, you know. And I think that that's all we got to think in the world right now. Like, it's crazy. A lot of stuff is going on right now, but we got to have that will and that drive. And I feel like we do have that power to continue to push, you know, like. And this Muhammad Ali piece, you know, it really represents just finding that power and that will within you, no matter where you're from or no matter who you are, like, it's there, you know, and the colors just like kind of just bounce off of him. And it's more like a, hey, this is my world, you know, let's make it better, you know. And, you know, it's crazy. Like, I was just talking to someone else too, and she said that, you know, someone told her that let's try to make the world a better place every day we wake up. And I think that that's kind of what this represents a little bit, you know, like, you know, if we have the power and the will within ourselves, like, that's all we really need to make the world a better place. You know what I mean?
Right. Absolutely. The constant in your life, or at least in the last few years, I have come to know you obviously as painting, but your life has changed drastically since you were unhoused and you were experiencing homelessness. You're a father, you're engaged. Tell us about this part of your life.
Oh man, it's probably the only thing that's keeping me grounded in being able to be the artist that I am, and that's my fiance, Kelsey, and my daughter. Like, you know, we went through everything together, like within those 2 years that you met me, like a couple years after that, you know, we, you know, because I had aged out of the program, we experienced, you know, homelessness ourselves together, mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? But we had, you know, the good thing is we had a job, we had an income, so we had money to pay for like hotels and stuff, but like it wasn't stable at the time. And the one thing that I learned from anybody being in your life, it's like, you know, you got to cherish those people that are there for you when you're down, you know. And she's shown more than that than anyone in my entire life, the 25 years I've been alive, you know. She's just been there for me, she's rode for me, and I love her, like, you know, more than anything in this world. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't wait till we can walk down that aisle and get married together, and you know, our family is just expanding to also. And honestly, like, that experience with her is just like, it's so hard to explain. I feel like when you're in love, you'll understand, but like it's simple for me, I guess. But you know, she's the main reason why I'm doing what I'm doing. My daughter and Kelsey, you know, they're the reasons why I continue to push, you know. Mm-hmm. There's times where I'm like, I don't feel like I want to do this anymore, and she's like, no babe, you got this. Things like the Golden One Center happen, you know, when I least expect it. So
what did that feel like when you see it outside the arena?
Honestly, you know, it's crazy. Like, I'm gonna be honest, like, I didn't think it was that big of a deal until like a bunch of people were like, dude, this is crazy, you know, there's a lot of people trying to do this, it's cost lots of money to do this. And I thought about it, I was like, okay, maybe it's that big of a deal. I guess like at first it wasn't like that big to me, but as I like kind of looked at it, I'm like, okay, no, this is a big deal, you know. So at first I didn't feel like a big deal, but then I realized it is a big deal, you know.
It is a big deal. You should feel very proud about that. Before we let you go, you know, you're talking about your fiance and your child, and art is still very much a part of your life. But has it taken on a deeper meaning now that you have, your heart is just fuller with being a father and being engaged?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it makes me realize that I can do more than just what I'm doing right now, you know, like, I mean, like, my heart is in like teaching people that it's okay, that what you can do, you can do what you love, you know what I mean? So like, that's really my main focus. Like, I know that, like, if I connect with the right people, like, you know, I can teach what I can do to other people, and that's my goal. You know, I do like side art classes and stuff for people, like pop-up shows and stuff, but like really it's just like I think that my art can take me in a different way, and I think that just like you said, the whole 2 years that you've known me and seen me and followed me has showed that, you know, my art can take me anywhere I want to go as long as I'm willing to put in the work for it. And I think that that's what I want my artwork to do, is to show that, you know, put in this work and we can make things happen, such as things, changes in the community, you know, a lot of different things can happen, you know.
As long as you have the power and the will, right?
Exactly.
That is Jermaine Tilson, an artist and muralist based in Sacramento. Our conversation first aired in February. That wraps a special edition of Insight. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Also, if you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Carell Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineers are Antonio Munez and Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.